Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. At this time of year, I usually like to give a teaching from the bhikkhunis, the nuns from the time of the Buddha. This is for two reasons. One is that the December full moon is in Sri Lanka the time that we traditionally remember that the Arahat, the fully enlightened nun Sanghamitta, came to Sri Lanka in the 3rd century BC and brought with her not only a sapling from the tree that the Buddha was sitting under when he became enlightened, but also brought with her the nun's ordination. The Bhikkhuni lineage left India at that time and was taken to Sri Lanka, and that was the start of that ordination going throughout the world and moving eventually from Sri Lanka into China and to Korea and Japan. And because of that nun's ordination leaving India way back then, we have nuns here in Australia today, and we have the possibility to practice in the way that the Buddha established 2,500 years ago. So this is the month in which we remember that. And it's also important for us to remember it so that we remind ourselves that there were enlightened nuns at the time of the Buddha and after the time of the Buddha, and that it is still possible in this day and age for women and men to become enlightened. And so I like to particularly at this time of year give a teaching that comes from the nuns. But this time I'm going to give a teaching not that wasn't actually given by one of the enlightened nuns, but was given to a group of nuns by one of the Buddha's enlightened disciples, Venerable Nandika. Not a name that we hear very often, but he was one of the Buddha's enlightened disciples. And each half month, it was one of the duties of the Bhikkhu Sangha to give teachings to the bhikkhunis, to the nuns. This was one of the ways in which the Buddha ensured that the nun sangha had access to the teachings in the same way that the bhikkhus had. So it was the duty of one of the very developed members of the sangha to go and give a teaching to all of the nuns in that district. And this particular teaching is so significant because after receiving the teaching, many of the nuns became fully enlightened. And the description is that there were 500 nuns, and after the teaching, the least of them was a stream winner. In that group of 500, which usually in Pali just means a big number, not necessarily exactly 500, but a large group, all of those nuns attained some state of sainthood, either as stream winners, as once returners, non-returners, or as fully enlightened arahats. So this teaching is very important because it was a teaching which enabled these nuns to, as the Buddha said, realize their intention. And some of them fully realize the intention to the point of enlightenment. So So I'd like to share that teaching with you tonight. And the teaching isn't something that is extraordinary in the sense that it doesn't appear in other places in the Pali Canon. The teaching is quite a straightforward teaching in the way that the Buddha very often presented the Dharma to his disciples, whether they were monks, nuns, laymen or laywomen. And we have also an account of the Buddha teaching his own son, Rahula, with a very similar kind of exposition of the Dharma. So what we're going to reflect on tonight isn't something that was special, but it just happened that that teaching was the teaching which allowed these nuns to build on the insight which they had developed up to that point and allowed them to make the final breakthrough to enlightenment. This teaching is in a very standard form in that it is the teacher asking the students a series of questions. And this is something which very often the Buddha and his disciples used in that time, because all of the teachings were passed on by word of mouth. They weren't written down. And so it was important for people to hear the questions again and again and again, because the questions gave some direction for where they should be looking in their own life, what they should be examining in their own experience, so that they could start to understand more clearly what the teaching was about. And in this particular dialogue, Venerable Nandika says to the bhikkhunis, "I'm going to ask you these questions, and if you don't understand them, you must let me know. But if you understand them, you also must let me know, so that I have an idea of where we're going in this teaching, and where you're at in this teaching." And the first question that Venerable Nandika asks the nuns is the I permanent or impermanent? Not the I meaning me or the self, but just the physical I. Is the I permanent or impermanent? And the nuns answer, "Impermanent, Venerable Sir." And how do you know this? Well, we know it from our own experience. The I can be damaged through illness. It can be damaged through accident. It can be just damaged because of aging. And even if we just close our eyes, the eye disappears. The function that the eye performs is gone if we close our eyes. So the eye is impermanent. And then Venerable Nandika says, "Is something which is impermanent a cause of suffering or happiness?" And the nun's reply is, "It's a cause of suffering, Venerable Sir." And we might say, well, is it always a cause of suffering? If we have a sore eye and that soreness goes, then it's happiness, isn't it? Is it always a cause of suffering? And the reason why it's a cause of suffering is because, yes, sometimes painful things disappear, unpleasant things disappear, but so do the pleasant, so do the things that we like, so do the things that we want to keep. And this impermanence is uncontrollable. It's something which is uncertain. And so because of its uncertainty and the instability of pleasant and unpleasant things, but particularly those pleasant things that we want to hang on to, what is impermanent is a cause of suffering. And then Venerable Nandika says, how do you know this? And the nuns say, because we've seen it in our own experience. We've had these kinds of experiences ourselves where the thing that we wanted to keep, we weren't able to. So we know that it's impermanent and it's suffering. And then Venerable Nandika says, right, well, is it correct then to take something which is impermanent and a cause of suffering to be me, to be myself, to be who I am? And the nuns answer, well, no, Venerable Sir, it isn't. And the assumption here is that if we're looking for a permanent self, for the essence of who we are, the thing that really makes me, then it has to be something that doesn't change, something which is stable, which is unique to me, and something which brings pleasure, something which brings happiness and upliftment, not something which brings suffering and pain. And so Venerable Nandika says, correct. To assume that the I, the physical I, which is impermanent, which is a cause of suffering, is me, is incorrect. But what about the ear? And he goes through all of the sense bases, the ear base, the nose base, the tongue base, the body base, and even the mind. All of those things, are any of them permanent? Are any of them free of suffering? And the nuns answer, no, Venerable Sir. So all of these senses can't rightly be taken to be me, to be who I am, to be mine. But what about the things that we see or that we hear, that we smell, that we taste, that we touch, that we think about? Are any of those things different? Well, no, Venerable Sir, they're all impermanent. And there's suffering bound up in them when we can't get the ones we want, or we're forced to be with the things that we don't like, the food that we don't like. It's not delicious, but we've got to eat it because that's what's on the plate. The sound, the music that we don't like, but someone else is playing it in the house and we can't avoid hearing it. Cause of suffering. Venerable Nandika says, well, the eye base, the sense that sees, and the thing that's seen, what about the seeing itself? Because usually we say, I see, I hear, I smell, I taste, I feel, I think. How does that arise? Well, if we examine it, and this is what he was encouraging the nuns to do, was to see that thinking, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, feeling cannot arise without the eye and something to be seen, without the ear and something to be heard, without the nose and a smell, without the tongue and a taste, without the body and a touch, without the thought, without the mind and thoughts. So this I that sees is something which is produced dependent on other things, dependent on the eye and the form, the ear and the sound. Only then, when those things come together, does seeing consciousness arise. And only then can we say, I see, I hear, I smell. And all of the other things, the experiences which we take to be I, me, mine. And the pleasant or unpleasant feeling that arises when we see something that we like. Again, is it permanent or impermanent? Is it for happiness or suffering? Does it arise independent of causes and conditions? Does it arise as I, me, mine? Or does it arise only when the right conditions are there? That pleasant feeling which gives rise to, I want that. I like that. Get away. Get rid of that. Unpleasant feeling. Pleasant and unpleasant both arise dependent on the sense base, the object, the contact, the consciousness arising. Now, Venerable Nandika went on to ask the nuns, again, is this something that can be taken to be a self? If it can't arise except when the right conditions are there. And the nuns answered correctly, well, no, sir. How do you know this? Well, we know because we've examined what produces seeing and what happens when I see something I like and what happens when I see something I don't like. It happens as a process dependent on causes and conditions. And Venerable Nandika goes on to give an illustration for those who may not have understood the point of this teaching. He says, suppose we have an oil lamp and that oil lamp burns dependent on the oil and on the wick in the lamp and the flame that's produced. Now, the light that arises, dependent on the flame, dependent on the wick, dependent on the oil, would it be correct to think of that light that's produced as independent, as existing apart from those causes and conditions? And the nuns answered, well, no, sir, without the wick, without the oil, without the flame, there can't be any light. And Venerable Nandika says, correct. And what about this situation? Suppose we have a tree that has roots, a tree that has a trunk, a tree that has branches with leaves. All of them have to be there for that tree to survive. But what about the shadow that's produced by the tree? Can that shadow exist on its own? Does it have any independent existence apart from the tree? And the nuns answer, well, no, sir, because the tree has to be there for the shadow to be there. And the tree can't be there unless the roots are there, the trunk is there, and the branches are there. So they're all dependent. None of them can exist separately on its own. And Venerable Nandika says, well, certainly that's correct. And so how is it that you can take the feeling that arises dependent on I, object, consciousness arising and producing that feeling, how is it that you can take that feeling to be self, to be who you are, to be the truth of the situation, when it's just like that shadow, when it's just like the light that comes from the lamp. It doesn't exist except when the conditions come together to produce it, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, whether it lasts for a short time or a long time. It doesn't have any independent existence. And yet, how often do we take that feeling to be me, to be the truth? Because we say, I feel. This is my feeling. And when that feeling is present, it propels us into speech and action. It propels us even mentally into thinking about how we're going to get the object that we believe has made that feeling arise. How are we going to get that thing that we want to keep? How are we going to remove that thing that we don't want because it gives rise to an unpleasant feeling? So believing this unpleasant feeling as the truth and identifying with it as mine, as me, as something I have to do something with, this produces thought, speech and action. Now if we reflect on these two illustrations of the light of the lamp and the shadow of the tree, we can perhaps start to glimpse that this thing which we take to be so much who we are is just a produced phenomenon, and produced depending on causes and conditions. And those causes and conditions depend on what we've been exposed to previously in our life and in our experience. When the right causes and conditions come together, they produce a particular feeling. And in our wrong understanding, our ignorance, we take that to be absolutely true because it's how I feel. And this is true, the Buddha said in the teaching to his son Rahula, this is true of our thoughts, of our emotions, of our ideas. All the things that we take to be me, mine, my thoughts, my ideas, they're all produced phenomenon. When we can start to understand this, when we can start to see this, when we can start to unravel this process, then we start to unravel this sense of self. And it makes us a little more cautious about believing the thoughts, the ideas, the beliefs that come into our mind. It makes us a little bit more skeptical about them. We don't take them as necessarily being the whole story, the true picture, or something that we have to act on just because we think it, just because we feel it. This kind of contemplation is something which is possible for all of us to do if we understand the process of cause and effect that produces our experience. So we can start to investigate, is it true that the I coming together with an object, when the mind is paying attention, produces seeing, not that I see, just seeing happens because the conditions are right. One of the conditions that's necessary also is that there's enough light to see. Otherwise the eye can't make out the form even if it's right in front of us. So when the conditions are enough, are adequate, then we see. Seeing happens whether we like it or not. And reaction to seeing happens whether we like it or not. We don't choose the reaction that arises. A reaction just arises because of past, because of conditioning. This kind of contemplation is something that we can do even if we're not spending lots of time doing our meditation practice, for example. Very often people say, well, I haven't got enough time for meditation. I can't spend time sitting down meditating. I'm too busy. Well, we don't have to sit down to do this kind of contemplation. We just have to learn to pay attention. So we can pay attention in all situations, or we can take just one sense, like seeing or hearing, and try to notice that when it arises. How is it that I can hear that sound? Did I choose to hear that sound? Was it deliberate? Was it the sound that I wanted to hear? Could I keep out the sounds I don't like and only hear the sounds that are nice to the ear? We start to examine it in our own experience, and then we start to contemplate whether the sound that arises is permanent or impermanent, and whether it's suffering or not suffering, and whether the feeling that arises when we hear a sound comes according to my choice, according to my wishes, or just arises because the conditions are right for the arising of feeling. Now, the Buddha said that feeling arises automatically when contact takes place, when hearing takes place, when seeing takes place. We can examine that in our experience. Just be aware of that gut, the feeling in the gut, the non-verbal reaction to whatever it is that we're coming in contact with through the senses. Before we even think about it or work out what it is, just that inner shudder or that tingle that goes through, that ha feeling when it's something that we enjoy, that sort of contraction that takes place when it's something unpleasant. Start to notice that and ask ourselves, did I order that? Was that what I wanted? Is it permanent or impermanent? Is it for my suffering or for my happiness? We take up this kind of reflection again and again and again. Doing it regularly, frequently and repeatedly, so that we start to break down this sense of me as something that is compact, something that exists somewhere inside this body and mind. We start to break down that compactness when we see hearing arising and falling away, and then seeing arising and falling away, and then thinking about what we've seen arising and falling away. All these things arising and falling away, not a solid experience, but one experience after the other. When we're able to reflect in this way and we start to see this process happening, and then we start to become a little bit skeptical about our reactions, we can become more discerning in how we speak particularly and how we act, but also how we think about what it is that we're experiencing. Instead of just taking as the truth how we've always thought about things, we start to examine them, open up our mind to different alternatives. And this is why this teaching is so important, whether we're monastics or lay people, because it applies to the way that we live our everyday life. It applies to the way that we engage in our relationships with others. Because all of us have this very strong sense of me having to come out and engage with the world, deal with the world. And this very strong sense of fixed views of how the world is and how the world should be. Ideas about other people, ideas about situations, which we very often fail to really examine once we've established an opinion about it, an attitude about it. And some of these opinions and attitudes we've brought with us from childhood, and we've never taken another look at them. Some of them we've brought from school days. Our experience at school still lives on in our mind now. And we don't even know it. That's the trouble. We're not aware of it. But it colours the way we relate to situations now. And because we take this self to be so solid, so fixed, so permanent, it's almost frightening to think about questioning any of those assumptions, challenging any of those attitudes or ideas. But when we start to wake up to the reality that what we took to be fixed and permanent and something that has to be stable and solid in order for us to be safe, when we start to challenge that through understanding that the whole of our experience, moment to moment, is just a process, just a series of causes and effects, causes and conditions coming together and creating this illusion of something permanent that's having one experience after the other. When we start to crack that open, when we start to challenge it, then it becomes possible to challenge our attitudes and our ideas and our assumptions about the world. And let me give you a very concrete example of how this teaching can help us to take away our suffering, just in the way that we deal with everyday challenges. Someone came to speak with me recently who's a mother of a student who's in year 11 this year. And she was telling me how nerve-wracking it is because year 11 is coming to an end and year 12 is looming. And year 12 is the TEE year. That's the year when the exams happen, the big exams happen. Very familiar story. And this person was telling me that she's already anxious about the exam that her daughter's going to do in 10 months' time. She's already worried. She's already tense. And she's already having arguments with a child about how much study she should be doing to get ready for the exam. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Now, this is a typical situation. It's a difficult situation both for the student and for the parents. And we know that when the students are doing TEE, the parents are doing TEE too. And sometimes grandparents as well, and aunties, and everyone's affected. So I was asking this this mother, first of all, to recognise, yes, this is a stressful situation, but to examine her assumptions about what TEE and doing TEE means. Where did she get all of her ideas about how significant this is going to be in her child's life? That it's going to be the be-all and end-all, the make or break. If there's something doesn't happen in this exam, then the rest of the life is just going to be over. No point, it's going to be worthless. That kind of idea, which when she started to look at it, was really how she was thinking about this exam, this one exam. And as we discussed, and I pointed out, you know, there's no guarantee, even if you get top result in the exam, that you're going to live happily ever after because of that. And there's no guarantee, even on a mundane level, that you're going to get the course that you want to do, or that you're going to like that course, or that it's the kind of course that you're going to want to put into practice when you leave your training, that you want to make it your career. Who knows? And I have any number of parents coming to speak with me who tell me that after the child does the TEE and gets a good result, there's so much stress when they go to university because they've got exam after exam after exam and year after year after year, and they have to keep on working hard, and there's so much more stress at university because you can't keep tabs on them as easily as you did when they were at high school. You don't know where they are and what they're meant to be doing and when the assignments are due, so it's even worse. And then I have parents coming and saying to me, oh, that was nothing. You wait till they graduate from university and they're trying to get the job that they want. They set their heart on, or we set our heart on, and it's so hard to get the jobs. You know, they're so competitive and they have to even compete against their friends. And then they go out and they get the job that they want. And then they have to work so hard to keep it. It's a rat race out there, you know, and it's terrible. There's so much stress in the home when they've just gotten their first job because they are just striving so hard. They have terrible hours. They can't come home and eat, can't come home and sleep. They're off to work again. Can't keep tabs on them at all when they're working because they're free and they've got money in their pocket. It's terribly stressful. Now, this is what I hear again and again and again, and yet here is a mother stressed out a year in advance because her child is going to do the TEE with the assumption that that is going to be make or break, happiness or sadness forever and ever afterwards. And this sounds crazy until we stop to examine what our thoughts are telling us. When we hear it like that, yes, how ridiculous. And that's only the assumptions about the exam itself. Now we get into all the questions about, well, how much study is enough? A Year 11 student should do this much study, but how much study should a Year 12 student do? And how much time should they put into their main subjects? And how much time should they give to their extracurricular activities, the ones that broaden their scope? And how much time should they have for relaxing? Well, maybe no time for relaxing. They should spend 100% of their time on their study if they're going to get the best result. And we hear this is what the mind is saying. Hey, why aren't you studying? Well, I've just spent 6 hours. Yeah, 6 hours studying's good, but, you know, back to the books. This is what the mind is saying, and this poor mother is stressed. Another year of study like this. This is what the mind is telling her. So we need to examine, first of all, the thoughts, the ideas, the opinions. Where do they come from? Are they based in reality? Have you discussed study habits with a teacher? Have you discussed study habits with the teacher who's should know how much work your child is doing? Or are you getting it from your friends or from the newspapers or magazines? Or, you know, how reliable is the source? Or maybe you're thinking about, well, when I was at school, this is how much we did and we were never allowed to go out and we didn't do all of these other things. Maybe you're thinking about what it was like 20 years ago or 10 years ago. And maybe some of those thoughts are accurate. Maybe some of them hit the mark. Maybe they are necessary and helpful. But which ones are they? We very rarely stop to ask ourselves those questions because we assume, I'm thinking this, so it must be true. I feel this. I'm so anxious about this exam. I've got so much invested in my child's success. That must be good. That must be right because I'm the parent, so it must be right that I'm so anxious. It must be right that I expect so much. If I worry enough, maybe that'll make it happen. If I go through all the stress with the child, maybe that'll make them perform better. These are the kind of assumptions that we have, which we don't even realise we have. And some of them may be useful. Yes, it's wonderful when parents support their children, when they do realise how stressful it is, when they do have an interest in what their children are doing. But there has to be a limit too. Parents have to see how much am I doing this because I want it and how much am I doing it because I really think this is what's going to be helpful for my child. Now, this is just one example. It's not just parents that have all these ideas that they've never looked at. We all have. We all have. And we're all having these blind spots where we just assume that what we've been thinking for years is the truth. What we've been putting out in our speech and our action is true and right. Because that's how we've always done it. That's what's me. And so this teaching encourages us to start questioning. And if we're going to question, then we have to somehow have glimpsed that what we've taken to be solid, what we've taken to be permanent, what we've taken to be fixed, that is me and my experience, is actually none of those things. It's a process, a series of interactions of cause and effect. The I base has to be there in order for seeing to arise. There has to be something to see in order for the I to see. In order for seeing consciousness to arise, we have to be paying attention. When seeing takes place, automatically an internal reaction is produced. That internal reaction is based on what we've experienced in the past. In the present, if we recognize that, we can stop, think, question, is what's arising now still relevant? Still truthful, still the full picture, or is it just part of the picture? It was true in the past. It's no longer true in the present. And this is very important to catch. Even though it's arisen, it doesn't mean that it's still true in the present, that it's still the whole picture in the present. It's just part of the total. And as we become more skillful at recognizing the various influences that have produced our attitudes, our ideas, our emotions, then we also become more skillful at removing those causes so that they no longer produce the same reactions in the present. So the idea that being successful at the TEE is going to be the guarantee of success and happiness for my child for the rest of their life, that contributes to the terrible anxiety around, but what if they don't do well? So we notice that wrong idea and we challenge it and we remove it little by little until we notice that when we don't have that idea in our mind any longer, the anxiety that goes together with the thought of the TEE is also reduced, is also affected once that idea is removed or at least challenged. This is how this kind of approach to our practice can be so beneficial. But we have to be willing to take up this kind of contemplation again and again and again, because our old habits die hard. Our old assumptions are very strong, and the sense of self, which has been built up over lifetimes, is not likely to be eroded just by seeing conditioning once or twice. But even if we're not practicing meditation diligently, we can do this kind of reflection in our own life. And in this particular teaching to the nuns, because they had been taking up this kind of contemplation again and again and again, when they were asked the questions about, is the eye permanent? Is the ear permanent? Is the nose permanent? Are forms permanent? Are sounds permanent? Etc., etc. Is the seeing that arises permanent? Is the hearing that arises permanent? All of those questions, they knew from their own experience, none of them is permanent. And are they a cause for happiness or suffering? They knew from their experience, suffering is inherent in all of these processes, because first of all, it's not in our control, what we see, what we hear, what we smell, all of those things, and we can't hold on to it. The ones that we like fade away, and the ones that we don't like also fade away. So having known that from their own experience, they were able to penetrate very deeply through the illusion of self. And being able to penetrate through that illusion, they were able to free their minds from attachment. Attachment to our views and opinions. Attachment to our wrong way of seeing things. To our wrong way of understanding things. And by being able to give up those attachments, the mind was freed from suffering. In cultivating this path, though this kind of approach with contemplation is one of the very useful ways of practicing, obviously if we want to make real progress, we need to support the contemplative mind with all of the other aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path. Keeping precepts and living virtuously helps the mind to be more peaceful and calm, to have less inner distress. Practicing meditation helps the mind to become strong, focused, and more stable, so that we can apply our attention to the areas of our life that we want to examine. The meditative mind, the mind that's developed through meditation practice, is able to focus and to stay focused without slipping away, without getting distracted. And with the support of virtue and the support of meditation, the mind becomes much more clear seeing. We can pick up the things which we previously missed because we just weren't on the ball enough. We didn't have the strength of mind to keep on examining our experience. We always fall back into our habitual ways of thinking and doing. So in order to bring the contemplation to life, we can't neglect the virtue and the concentration part of the path. And as we use the developed mind in contemplation, we will give rise to wisdom, or the mind will give rise to wisdom. Wisdom that is based in our own experience. Wisdom that is coming from within our own mind, not something which is just being passed on to us by someone else. And as we continue to cultivate the sila, samadhi and panya, the morality, the concentration and the wisdom in our life, so much suffering will fall away, and with its falling away, so much happiness and peace will arise in its place. So my wish for all of you is that you may follow in the footsteps of the enlightened nuns from the time of the Buddha and up to this day, who were able to apply this teaching in their life and realize the fruits of the path. May the merit of this teaching, which we share tonight, help us all to attain Nibbana. If anyone has any questions or comments, I'd be happy to try to answer them. Yes? Right, so the question is about my karma, because that seems to be the thing that we feel most that we own. That's only if we've practiced the Buddha's teaching. If we very often we have all sorts of other things that we think we own apart from our karma. But the Buddha said, yes, we're the owners of our karma. And first of all, we have to understand that what karma is, karma and karma vipaka. Karma means action. And it means any intentional movement of the mind, actually. Any intentional thought, speech or action produces karma, vipaka, produces a fruit or a resultant because of it. So again, it's the law of cause and effect. The effect always matches the quality of the cause. So speech which is kind produces a resultant, a fruiting of something that is pleasant, that produces happiness. Speech which is unkind, which is negative, spoken intentionally, deliberately, produces a resultant that is like that, unpleasant, unhappiness. And this is something which conditions and affects the future. It affects the next moment of our life. And this is the way in which we can say that we own it, because it does produce the next mind moment. But because the mind arises and passes away so quickly, we very often aren't aware of that effect that is being produced in the next moment. The teaching is that the effect doesn't just last for the next moment, it lasts into the future much further. Sometimes that karma will fruit in this life itself, and sometimes it will fruit in future lives. The karma fruits according to causes and conditions. And this is the way in which we could say that it is not self. We can't choose when the karma is going to ripen. Just as we can't choose to have a nicer karma than the one that we made. Once it's made, it's made. But when it ripens will depend on other supporting causes and conditions. It's like various ingredients coming together to make a cake, depending on whether you put more flour than liquid in, you'll have a dry cake. If you put more liquid than flour, you'll have a very moist cake. And if you put spices into that cake, depending on whether it's very dry or very moist, those spices will be stronger or weaker. The whole of those ingredients combine together to affect one another. And so the taste of the cake is not just dependent on one ingredient. The fruiting of karma is like this. The quality of the action produces a vipaka, a fruiting that is similar to that. But depending on the cake in which it's baked, the other ingredients that are present will decide on when and where and with what potency that karma is experienced. And so in that sense, it again is not self, but in the sense that the me that experiences the fruiting will have changed many times from the me who produced it in the first place. So again, you could say that it's not really me that's experiencing it, but because there's continuity through this life and through rebirth, there is continuity in the sense that the mind that produced that original action has fallen away but produced the next moment and the next moment and the next moment likewise. So there is this continuity, and that's the way in which we can say that we are receiving the fruits of the karma that we've made. So if we are happy in this moment and we speak nicely to someone, even though our mind has changed between those moments, we're perhaps no longer paying attention to that person that we spoke to when we spoke with a kind thought in our mind. The good feeling, the pleasant feeling that's produced is something which the mind experiences in the next mind moment. And the fact that we've said something nice produces happiness in the other person, and they say something nice back to us. So we get back something, but it's not the same me from moment to moment. Our mind has already changed many, many times between the words being said and receiving back the words that the other person gives to us. I don't know whether that answers or addresses the question, but it runs around on karma anyway. Well, I think we've probably had enough now. It's after 9 o'clock. I have been asked if I could just, before Sol makes the other announcements, I have been asked to remind all of you or bring to your attention the fact that this is the time of year when we make a special appeal in the Buddhist society for funds for the orphanage in Bangladesh, which we support. This is the only project outside the Buddhist Society's projects that we actively raise funds for during the year. This is an orphanage in Bangladesh, which is predominantly a Muslim country, but this is an orphanage for Buddhist children who come from some of the hill tribes and ethnic groups which are traditionally Buddhist. And Bangladesh is a very poor country, as you are probably aware, and the minority groups in that country are the poorest in the country. And these children are orphans who depend for their support and protection on the monks and the lay people who run these orphanages. And the orphanages provides equal facilities for males and females, which is something which is very noteworthy in that situation. And this year, the project which the orphanage is raising funds for particularly is for the girls' dormitory. And any money that we raise and send to them, a proportion of that will be put towards the dormitory. Now, the funds that we send make a tremendous difference to their situation, but it's not enough to do all of the work. And so they are scheduling the building of the dormitory to take a number of years for them to complete. This isn't a large organisation. The orphanage doesn't have large sums of money coming in from various donor groups, and so they are really appreciative of whatever we can offer them. And so every year at this time, for the next few weeks until Christmas, we put collection boxes at the back of the hall, and there's information about the orphanage there for you to see. People from the Buddhist Society have gone to the orphanage and can verify that it's being run very well, that the funds are used in a very wise way, a very caring way, and that the children are benefiting greatly from the support which we offer. So we encourage any of you, if you're able to, over the next few weeks to make some donations to the Bangladesh orphanage. And if you have any questions about the orphanage or the projects that they're doing, you can speak to Scott, who's our caretaker, who's been there and knows about the project personally, or you can take a look at the information boards at the back of the hall.